And welcome back to Coast, where we will take your phone calls this hour with Stephen Schwartz as we talk about ETs and consciousness and so much more on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Stephen Schwartz with us as we talk about consciousness and aliens as well. Do you think aliens know what we're thinking, Stephen?
That's a really interesting question. In the novel Awakening, I have the aliens communicate by mind-to-mind contact, because I think that that's where we're headed evolutionarily. So I don't know. I mean, we don't have a lot of hard information. I think it's very possible that they would have a much more advanced idea of consciousness, because I think the only way you can develop interstellar travel is to understand the fundamental consciousness architecture that lies beneath all physical reality. I mean, so the answer to your question, I would speculate, and it's no more than that, would be yes. I don't know that, of course. Nobody knows.
Nobody knows for sure. But you have also looked at fear on this planet. What is causing that?
Fear?
Yes.
Well, I think we are going through a great schism that is arising because of fear. I think there are four great meta trends that are going on in the world today, and nobody talks about them. But they are the defining trends that are shaping the culture at the moment. The first trend is being born white will no longer confer privilege. The second trend is being born male will no longer bestow dominance. The third trend is Western European and North American culture values will no longer be the defining way in which the world runs. And the fourth trend is the transfer of real power from the nation state to multinational virtual corporate states, and the rise of what I call neo-feudalism, in which a tiny group of people control almost everything. There is a professional class who service their interests, basically, and then there is a huge economic peasantry. And those four trends, which I can see happening almost day by day, I do a daily web publication called Schwartz Report that tracks trends.
That's right.
And I see this every day. I do story after story. So the other thing is that about 27%, according to the research, about 27% of the population have overactive right amygdalas. And the amygdala is a little gland about the size of an almond in your brain that is involved with fight or flight. And it correlates very strongly with conservative religiosity and conservative politics. And when it kicks in, fight or flight, rational thought goes down. And I think we've just got a lot of very fearful people who see the world changing in fundamental ways that make them deeply unhappy, because they feel a loss of status, a loss of anybody caring for them, feeling, you know, they lose status. And it's made them very angry and very fearful. And I think, plus with these migrations that are starting, the introduction of other cultural groups into established culture groups is causing an enormous amount of stress. I mean, you can see this with the immigration coming out of the Middle East. And we're going to begin, you can see it from in the United States. There is a tremendous amount of fear. Plus, I think there is a precognitive awareness of climate change. When you look at, you know, I spend time sort of binge watching. I usually do it in the summer. A television series, and it's very interesting because they have changed enormously. I mean, just to give you an example, interracial sex. Is interracial romance is now not only acceptable in Netflix, Stars, Showtime, HBO series, but it's almost inevitable. It's almost obligatory. In fact, there are now even shows in which there are transsexuals that are involved. There is a growing sense of fear of the other. And you see it in all these dystopian shows that about the future. They're all very dystopian, and that may in fact be where we go. But what I think it really is a projection of fear arising from the fact that so many people have a precognitive awareness. You know, there's a guy named Roger Nelson, a very good scientist.
Oh, good man. He works with Dean Radin.
Yes. Well, he's at Princeton, but yes.
Right.
And Roger, when he was working at Princeton, they were doing experiments to see whether individuals could make random number generators go non-random.
And they could.
And they could, yes, absolutely, reliably. Roger then asked the next question, and that is, if this is what an individual can do, what happens when there is a catalyzing event that coalesces human awareness in a large group of people, particularly when there's high emotion, things like Princess Diana's death or the tsunami in Japan.
Or 9/11.
Yeah, 9/11, absolutely. And so Roger put random number generators all over the world, and what he discovered, and he reports on it, you can go to his website, Global Consciousness Project, what he reports is that when these catalyzing events that coalesce human consciousness, particularly in a high emotional state, occur, these random number generators go non-random. Now, what is that telling us? I suggest to you that what it's telling us is consciousness manipulates reality. It's a bigger version of what I was saying earlier about the wine and water experiments or the freezing the water, the Emoto kind of experiments. What we are beginning to discover in the experimental laboratories is that consciousness has the ability to alter the informational structure of reality, not only physically altering it and causing physically objectively measurable changes, but also, as I said earlier, aesthetic changes, the way you react to wine, for instance, that there's no physical change, but there is an aesthetic change. We began seeing this, or I did, in remote viewing when I would bury objects in mason jars, and I put a perfume bottle a number of times, and then I would ask people, I put them in a grid of 144 squares. First, I'd ask people to locate which square had the bottle, and then to describe for me what was in the bottle. And when the perfume bottle, I would get comments like, well, the smell is the important thing about this. There's this fragrance to it that it's deliberately designed to have this fragrance. So they obviously can't smell it, but they are having an aesthetic reaction to it. And I think that this fear state that is driving so much of our political activity, so much of our cultural activity, arises because people have this precognitive awareness that something really cataclysmic is on the horizon, and we are not prepared for it. And so there's a lot of fear. So you add that fear, then you add those four big trends I described, and you can easily see why a very significant percentage of the population are in a kind of fear fugue.
Oh, you can feel it with people.
Oh, absolutely. I'm sure you do a lot of interviews with people who talk about this. I mean, it's in the media almost every day.
I just interviewed Monday Dean Radin, Stephen.
Ah.
And he is, they're doing another test. Not with random generators, but with Twitter. And what they're getting is they're getting results, and he's finding out about the event on Twitter before it happens. What he wants to do next is find out when and where. And so he's working on that. But it's amazing the results they're getting.
Yes, because what all of this is telling us is that all consciousness is interdependent and interconnected. That we are not isolated. We do not live entirely within our brains, dead meat, no consciousness. That we are, in fact, consciousness is the fundamental part of us, and the physical part of us is a manifestation of consciousness. And so what Dean and, I mean, myself and other guys that are doing this kind of research, men and women, what all of us are uncovering is this sense of the interconnection and interdependence of all consciousness. And there are lots of different ways it's being measured. But the takeaway, the headline is, you are not alone. You are part of a matrix of consciousness, not only of human beings, by the way, but of all living beings. I mean, we've done experiments where people are doing work with bacteria or with fungi. And also, importantly, that the effects of intentioned consciousness not only are auspicious, that is, they produce positive effects, but they can have negative effects. And that you see that, of course, anthropologically in the idea of the evil eye and voodoo stuff, and I mean, lots of sort of negative intentionality produces effects. We see it in the therapeutic intention research, healing research.
What do you mean, Stephen, by non-local consciousness?
I mean that aspect of consciousness which is not physiologically based and is not dependent on time and space.
Okay.
It's the part of us that survives. It's also the part of us that has creative breakthroughs. I did a series of papers a few years back in which I looked at the relationship between creative genius, spiritual epiphany, and things like remote viewing. And what I discovered was it was the same experience modulated by intention and context. That is, scientists hold the intention to gain insight into how the world works, and they have experiences that reveal that to them. Poincaré says, I saw the equation as I was walking across the street. Tesla says, I saw the electric motor as I was walking across Central Park. Einstein says, I saw relativity as I was idling away an afternoon in a canoe. I mean, on and on and on. And then you look at people who are great spiritual pilgrims, and they talk about this sense of connectedness with the greater whole and suddenly understanding things. And then you look at remote viewers, and they're trying to describe the teacup hidden in the closet. But it's essentially the same experience. They all report, I have a sense of connection with a greater whole. I feel like I'm part of some greater network. I feel a sense of timelessness and spacelessness. All of those experiences are awakening, opening to this non-local aspect of consciousness, and so is near-death experiences.
Do you think Leonardo da Vinci was a remote viewer?
Oh, yes. Well, that Leonardo da Vinci had the capacity to open to non-local consciousness, absolutely.
Yeah, he had to have. I mean,
yes.
Who would have thought of, everything that he has depicted?
Yeah.
With sketches. I mean, he saw those objects.
Yes.
That he painted.
Exactly. I mean, I could give you 100 of these things of people who have made breakthroughs that transform the whole course of history. And when you get down to the lick log, as we used to say in Virginia, where I'm from, what you find out is they describe this experience in which they are out of time, out of space. They have this sense of connection with a greater whole, and based on their intention and the context of the experience, they gain an insight that changes everything. I was walking across the Salk Institute campus with Jonas Salk once, and I said to him, "How did you discover the vaccine, the polio vaccine?" And he said, "Well, I work with my dreams."
It was an accident too, wasn't it?
Yeah. Well, what do you say? Well, no, not exactly. He said, "I work with my dreams," and you think about Kolka and the benzene ring, the dream of the snake following itself. You think of Descartes, who has three dreams in in 1619 that transform his understanding and cause him to gain insights that become a whole new form of geometry. I mean, there are endless stories like this. And when you talk to, Saint Teresa of Avila, she says, it's fascinating, given that she's a Roman Catholic nun, she says, forget about all the rituals. Forget about the priests. Go inside. Sit and listen and open yourself to this hidden part of yourself. Brahms says, I hear the music. When I'm in this meditative state, I hear the music and I just write it down. Mozart, same thing. Over and over, when you look at the relationship between creativity, spiritual epiphany, and non-local consciousness experiences, you see it as the same thing. It's all about opening to this aspect of the self that is not limited by space-time and not restricted to physical consciousness.
Once you realize how to use it, what does it do for you?
Oh, well, it does all sorts of things. I mean, just take meditation. You know, you go up to PubMed and do a Google on meditation. The National Institutes of Health, the National Medical Library, anybody can do it. It's free. Just go up and do a Google on meditation or do a search. It's not really a Google. Do search the database. And there are over several thousand papers. We know that meditation improves your health. It makes you sleep better. It improves your sex life. It raises your IQ. You can actually alter your DNA.
Lowers your blood pressure.
Lower your blood pressure, exactly. So there's a reason why both martial art dojos and monasteries teach people meditation. Because the key to all of this, George, this is actually, if nobody hears anything else in this whole interview, the key to this is the ability to attain and sustain intentioned, focused awareness. That's what meditation is about.
Yep.
That's what all these spiritual disciplines are about, to attain and sustain intentioned, focused awareness, because that allows you to open to the non-local part of your consciousness.
Isn't it what Jesus did?
Yes, and Buddha, and Muhammad. If you think about religion, all religions, think about it for a second, all religions begin because one individual has a non-local consciousness experience or experiences. That person, if they're charismatic enough and if they are able to explicate what they have experienced, people draw around them, they have followers that develop, but it all starts with one individual. But it's like genius. You know, genius is an individual experience, but it has to be accepted socially. Otherwise, you're just a crank. And the same thing is true of in terms of religion. You have to be attuned to your social context. And when you have these experiences, you have to be able to explicate and replicate. And so you teach people how to do this. I mean, you think about Jesus' teachings. Love God and love your fellows, and that is the whole of the law and the prophets. I mean, basically what he's saying is we are all interlinked and interdependent, and the well-being of some is the well-being of the total.
Taking away the fact that Son of God, how did he know this?
Because he was open. He was an individual who opened to non-local consciousness. I mean, there are lots of parts of religion. You know, the religion is a man-made structure of belief. People develop the dogmas, why they listen to the teachers, and then out of that, after the teachers are gone, they begin developing dogmas and rituals. If you think about it, look at religious rituals. Think about them as protocols, scientific protocols. What happens? You have a place that you go to gather. Whether it's a church or a synagogue or a temple or an Etruscan oak grove, it doesn't make any difference. There's the place. And there's a reason for that. You gather, you make a statement of shared intention. If you're a Christian, it's the Nicene Creed, but you know, if you have other religions, it's different things. But you are creating shared intention. There's a whole part now of the neurosciences called neurotheology. Started by a guy named Andrew Newberg, who's a neuroscientist, in which the next thing that happens is there is a period of time where there is dancing, singing, chanting, drumming, something, because why that happens, when that happens, there is brain in training.
That's a good point. Stephen, we're going to come back and wrap things up with phone calls next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to our final segment with Stephen Schwartz. His latest book is called Awakening, and we'll get to your calls. Stephen, where do we get your books?
Go to Amazon. I guess go to the bookstore.
Okay.
I guess the easiest way is Amazon. You can get it both as a print book and as an e-book.
Super. Now to the phones we go. As promised, first-time caller Robert, truck driving in Lexington, Kentucky. Hey, Robert, go ahead.
Hey guys, how are you this morning?
Okay, Robert, thank you.
I've actually just got a few questions about the extraterrestrial, I guess. Now, I kind of shrugged that off a little bit and focused on the other things. But really, my question is, with all these UFO sightings and things of that nature that people have caught on camera and documented, and the government tells them it's just them doing top secret operations at night and going on about their business. Now, is there any truth to that, or could it actually be extraterrestrial UFOs?
Well, I would say this to you, Robert. On the 29th of March in France, they took photographs from a helicopter of two somethings that look like flying saucers. And April, literally a few days ago, a couple of pilots, commercial pilots, described encountering and seeing something again that looked like kind of like a flying saucer. The astronauts, at least four of them that I can think of, Buzz Aldrin and Edgar Mitchell and Wagner, I can't think of his first name, they all claim that they saw unidentified flying objects, and in fact Buzz Aldrin took a lie detector test. So it isn't just not something that's just happening at night. People see these things with actually increasing frequency. I've been kind of fascinated because the number of reports that are coming in from very reliable sources, like, you know, combat pilots and that sort of thing, commercial pilots, astronauts, have actually seemed to be going up.
Yeah, they do. They're either more willing to talk to us or something's really happening out there.
Yes, and I think probably, Robert, that this is occurring because technologically we are right, as I was saying earlier in the program, we are at a kind of threshold place, and they're watching us, and they behave exactly like cultural anthropologists.
Now, Aldrin had a spokesperson who released a report just recently, Stephen, that said, look, I don't know what I saw, but I didn't say it was extraterrestrial. So he's kind of adamant about that.
Yes. No, he says he saw something that was kind of L-shaped,
mm-hmm.
which I thought was kind of odd. But anyway, something that was L-shaped. No, he's very careful, which is exactly what he should be. He's simply saying, I saw an unidentified flying object. Whether it was extraterrestrial or not, I don't know.
Right. Mitchell, on the other hand, and we've known Edgar, he said we're being visited by ETs.
Yes, Edgar took a much stronger position than anybody else, and apparently that was, again, based on his personal experiences. But, you know, you're having, it's very much like a primitive tribe who sort of catch a glimpse of a cruise ship going by. I mean, you know, you're a primitive living on an island somewhere in the Pacific, and a cruise ship goes by. I mean, what would you think?
I know. It's amazing work, isn't it?
Yeah.
Back to the phones we go. Walt in Pennsylvania's turn. Hey, Walter, go ahead.
Hi, George. I'm losing sleep over you, George.
Well, good. That's a good thing. We're doing something right here.
And Dr. Schwartz, a great conversation. As far as the ETs go, George, when we were growing up, the drones we have today could have easily been mistaken for ETs because they seem to levitate. And, George, how long is it going to be before we have drones that are big enough to transport people around? You know, runways will become obsolete, George.
Well, I'm not getting in a pilotless drone, that's for sure. I won't even get in a pilotless car.
He raises a very good point.
Hold on, Walt. Go ahead, Stephen.
Well, no, I mean, he's raising a very good point, and that is, I don't know, ETs, but the idea that they're going to be pilotless drones that'll be programmed to take people around, I think is It's not something that I'm looking forward to at the moment, certainly with the technology that exists today. But 50 years from now, oh, yes.
Maybe even sooner.
Yes.
Let's go back to you, Walt. Did you have a question there, Walt? Another one?
Well, George, Dr. Schwartz made the comment that something happened 45,000 years ago that really affected mankind. Now, there was, as I was telling Tom, there was a super volcano that erupted in the South Pacific Rim called Tova, which ejected 40 cubic miles of ejecta into the atmosphere, and it consequently affected the global climate and whatnot. And they estimate that there were may have been as many as 2 to 3 million human beings alive at that time, but only 40,000 survived the catastrophic eruption of Tova. So we were all descended from the 40,000 survivors. Now, you know, to say that an ET affected mankind 45,000 years ago, George, I think there's a better, a natural, more natural explanation for it, George.
Yeah, well, but how do we know the ETs didn't affect it? But go ahead, Stephen.
Well, I was just going to say, I should have been clear, I guess, in what I said. What I said to you when George was asking me, Walter, was that a rather famous thinker and writer, a man named Arthur Koestler, proposed that to me one night over dinner.
Was that the Hungarian or somebody else?
Yeah, no, that's the Hungarian.
He killed himself with his wife, you know.
That's correct.
Yeah. I studied up on that guy.
Yeah, I mean,
he had leukemia.
Left his estate to Edinburgh University to fund consciousness research.
Yeah, that's right. Exactly.
But I just made the point, Walter, that he said this to me. I don't know whether it's true. It stayed with me. It was such an off the wall kind of comment. And then as I began watching the DNA research arise and now the CRISPR technology that's taking place where they're really manipulating DNA, his idea, which I thought at the time was sort of kind of extraordinary, now makes kind of sense.
Mike in Reno, Nevada. It's your turn, Michael. Go ahead.
Well, I'm going to disagree and agree. Here's where Fine. I disagree. Your remote viewing ended at 94. The Soviet Union broke up in 91. AIDS was prevalent in the 80s. Computers were already on the horizon. So this is not necessarily a prophecy, given the your extended into 94.
No. I started in 78. They started telling me in 78 and 79 about AIDS. Nobody knew about AIDS. The Soviet Union doesn't disappear till 1991. So all through the 70s and 80s, when I was going to Russia on a regular, I had companies in Russia. I was very involved with the glasnost perestroika period. Nobody expected the Soviet Union to disappear.
And they didn't even expect it.
No, the Soviets didn't expect it. And I would go to do workshops or conferences where I would speak, scientific conferences, lay conferences, and I would get people to do these remote viewings, and they would all say to me, by 2050, the Soviet Union has disappeared. And it didn't make any sense to me at all. I was in Moscow the day the Soviet Union ceased to exist. I watched, I can't even think of his name now, climb up on the tank. I was in the Ukraine Hotel looking down at the White House in Moscow.
So that was under Gorbachev's tutelage, wasn't it?
Yes. Well, yeah. Gorbachev and then
Yeltsin?
Yeltsin, that's it.
Yeah.
You know, Yeltsin's speaking publicly and then Christmas, December 25th, 1991, it ceased to exist. Actually, I went down to the post office and bought the last stamps that they sold in the central Moscow post office. I bought a sheet of every stamp they had.
You still have them?
I still do, yes, absolutely. A guy named Manly Hall told me that whenever your country is going to disappear, buy the stamps. So I went down and bought all the stamps. But so I want to be very clear, this because this is important. Between 78 and 96, I did this experiment. Everything these people said, the consensually, has occurred But I do not say after about 1990, I stopped asking people about the Soviet Union. So, from 90 on, that just wasn't an issue. What struck me was beginning in 1978 and going on through the 80s, they kept talking about this, which I just thought was, at first I just dismissed it.
Manuel in San Antonio, Texas. Hi, Manuel.
Good morning. Hi, George, and hello, Stephen. I really appreciate you being on the air.
Thank you, Manuel.
Hello?
Yeah.
Okay. That instance about the astronauts saying that the reason why that they saw UFOs, especially when they were in the moon and everything, I knew a doctor who had gone while she was in school, and she went to go to a seminar that the astronauts were having over there at UT in Austin. And he said, or they all said, that the reason that they weren't going to the moon anymore was because the UFOs were using the moon as like a gas station. Okay?
And they didn't want us back. We've always heard those rumors. Never able to prove that, Stephen.
Yes. No, I don't. I'm sorry, Manuel. I can't add anything to that. I don't know.
And, I've never had an astronaut tell us that. Mitchell didn't even tell me that.
No, nor me. I mean, I've known a number of them. And, no, I just, is it possible? Sure. But I don't know anything about it.
It is interesting why we stopped and why Russia never went. And it's weird, isn't it?
It is weird. I think that's actually a subject that is worth some attention, and nobody has really studied it in a way that was definitive about what happened, why they cut off the money, because it's, of course, about money. Whether it was that they couldn't figure out how to go further. I mean, part of it is they learned we didn't get into this, but there is a whole body of research that has arisen about what happens when you get outside of the Earth's geomagnetic field.
Now, what do you mean?
Well, I mean, for instance, the Earth's geomagnetic field, which is what makes life possible on the Earth. I mean, that's what protects us.
Right.
But when you get outside of it, strange things happen to you. One of the astronauts told me he could no longer see the second hand of his watch, for instance. But there are a whole series of studies about the effects that happen when you move outside of the geomagnetic field. So there may have been, and we know, for instance, that bone density alters. I mean, there's a lot of medical stuff. And it may be that they decided that they couldn't figure out how to solve that problem, and so they put it off. But it is very unusual that, there are people, they were middle-aged who weren't even born when the space program stopped. I mean, we talk about it, but we're talking about the 60s. Most millennials, there was no space program when they were there.
Gosh, such a long time ago, Steve, wasn't it? My gosh. My gosh, we've only got about a minute left. Do we have time for Kevin in Sarasota, Florida? Kev, real quick question. Go ahead, sir. Kev, you there?
Yes. Hello. Can you hear me?
Yeah, but we've only got a minute for you, so go for it.
Okay. I wanted to describe a UFO sighting I had, if I could. It appeared sort of like a satellite, but it had no lights on it. But you could see the antenna, and it was at nighttime, and it just sort of drifted overhead. There were no sounds or anything.
But it was close enough for you to kind of make out what it was physically?
Yes.
Huh.
And, there was another person with me that saw it as well, and we were really baffled by it because it was so quiet.
Well, not all of them have lights, Stephen. That's
Oh, yes, absolutely.
That's for sure.
Well, think about this. How many cultural anthropologists from France have gone to study in New Guinea? How many American anthropologists have gone? It's not, there are 10 to the 22nd power or 24th power according to the European Space Agency, stars and many multiples of planets. So we're not being visited by one group. We're probably being visited by dozens.
Well, they think they're like 50 plus. Stephen, thanks again for being on the program. Stephen Schwartz, website linked up at coasttocoastam.com. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Laudasur, Stephanie Smith, Chris Borelson, George Knapp. I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.